thank you for the chance to walk into your word and to visit Mr. Moses again. We thank you for this precious, wonderful book of beginnings. We're reminded that lots of beginnings in this book. And as we see Jacob, and as we see Isaac, and as we see us, God, I'd ask that you would quicken our hearts where we can learn and show us how we can be better. And the message of this lesson, let it just take root in us tonight. Would you walk among us? Would you be the breath in our words? And Lord, would you just illuminate major truths for our lives that we can be better, serve you better, be a better witness, be a better emissary for you. And we ask that you would just be with us now in the name higher than all, Jesus Christ our Lord. You are in Genesis 27. You have bypassed middle, and we're on the patriarch section, which is, I think, entirely interesting because these guys you've heard of for years and years and years and years, now you get to meet them up close and personal. And it is a rather warning thing where up close and personal isn't always pretty. But isn't that the story of human nature? When you really get down to knowing a person's heart, only Jesus could stand us. I'm serious about that. When God looks at our heart, I'm so glad when he looks at mine, he sees his son in front of that and the blood that he shed for me, because mine can be awful. I can say and do awful things, and you know that. You're around me a lot, but we have that promise of the forgiveness, and that's what I am really grateful for. We're going to see some conniving tonight. We're going to see some maneuvering. We're going to see behind-the-scenes backbiting and knife-stabbing and cheating and thievery and lying. And if you think that's commiserate to just these guys, I want us to each look in our own homes, because I think you're going to see all these things, and I'm, like I said, thumb pointing back itself, I think you can see all these things any day in any quote Christian home too. I think we see all this because this is the story of us too. I am just going to start right in. I'm in Genesis 27. I'm in verse 1. Now it came to pass when Isaac was old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, that he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." Then he said, "Behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now therefore, please take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and make me savory food, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." We know for a fact, just from backtracking the genealogy, Isaac's about 137 years old at this time. What you're going to find is this. He's hinting that he's on his deathbed, and I had always understood this story to be, it's the night before he dies. And no, he lives like another 50 years or 40-some years. He lives to be 180 and 43, actually, more years. And so we get a little bit sidetracked in that I'm so old. I think Isaac is wanting sympathy. Remember, they're all kind of connivers. I'm going to lay this at all four people in this story. They're all less than what they should be for God. As am I, thumb pointing back itself. But that's the story here. These are the patriarchs, like Travis said. These are the guys we talk about. These are the bloodline of Jesus. And we're going to see shenanigans and backhanded deals. And we're going to see whisperings and just temple intrigue, like you see in a good soap opera. But that's kind of what's happened. So I think he's exaggerating. I think the truth is, and I can't prove this, again, like I tell you guys, you don't have to believe one thing I say. Search the scripture for yourself, like the Issachar family did, and that was counted to them for righteousness. Search for yourself. But it seems to me like that he had some, I want to say, not exactly lying, but maybe under table dealing in his mind. Because Isaac is the patriarch. His wife and him were told, because she had trouble getting pregnant for 20 years. And he was told with her, believe me, Rebecca and him talked. When God came and talked to Rebecca, he said, "You got twins in there. And the younger one's going to rule over the older." They knew it. Isaac knew it. Rebecca knew it, and those boys both knew it. Families talk. This is a tent society. They weren't busy on their iPads. We have to think back what they did. I mean, they gathered together. They ate every meal. They didn't run down to McDonald's for a burger. I mean, every meal was around Mom's table. And they were in tents, and they were talking, and they told stories. And her story about this conception, she never got pregnant again. This was her one pregnancy, kind of like the Sarah story, except she got twins. And as they talked, they would have to, those boys knew. Isaac knew. Rebecca knew. The younger one was to rule the older. And I'll prove that to you here in a minute with scripture. You remember it. Anyway, so I think if you set the story right, and let's look at what the text says. The text says, Isaac goes, I'm real old here. Well, he was. I mean, 137 is old. I'm real old here, and I'm probably not going to live very long, so you better go get me some food so I can give you the blessing. Now, see, there's a lot of half-truths in this. You better believe he's not starving. He's rich. They have servants. Rebecca cooks for him. He already knew that that was going contrary to God. I think this story needs to get these backgrounds, which I never knew before. I always just took it like, oh my gosh, he's on his deathbed, and he wants the older son to have the blessing. Well, he's not on his deathbed, and yes, he did want the older son to have the blessing, which was norm for the culture, but that's not what God said. And if you know anything about Almighty Jehovah, he's not tied to what the culture said. No, he's tied to his everlasting covenant. He's tied to his word. But he never said Esau will rule over Isaac. God never said that. And Rebecca knew it, and Isaac knew it. And I'm just wagering in the process of putting all these pieces together that the boys both knew it too. I think there are four people here involved in the shenanigans of this chapter. That's my take. You don't have to agree with me. But it would seem to me like this was a topic well understood by everyone involved. I looked at several commentators. This story is well documented in lots of articles, lots of journals, lots of commentaries. But what no one seems to talk about is, why would Isaac have done that? I mean, the question is posed often online. Why would Isaac have done that? And I come up with one word. Because he's human. We all make mistakes. We all have sin. And I believe his sin was, I think he preferred Esau over Jacob. I think if you know Isaac, you know, he probably was more of a hunter type, probably more of an outdoorsy kind of guy. I'm not saying that, Esau was rough and tumble. We know he was ruddy, which means red, and hairy. Which, if you look at those words, it doesn't mean that he looked like a big red gorilla. It just means he was a little bit different color. David's called ruddy. We know David probably was colored more like me. Probably light hair, light skin, and light eyes. And that's not typical for the Jewish family. And this is what I suspect Esau looked like. That's in that bloodline. I think he's red. I think he's got red hair. And he might have bushy hair. And big beard. I mean, he might have looked like a big red gorilla. And I think he was probably bigger and rougher. But people are born that way. People's natures are born that way. These two boys were entirely different. They're two different nations. We see the lineage of Esau today. The Arab countries are pretty much ruffians. I'm sorry, and I know that's not going to be kosher to say that. But they're rougher. They're fighters. They're outdoorsy, they're tough, and we see the Jews a little gentler people. They just are. And I'm not saying Jesus isn't the commander of the Lord's army and I wouldn't want to mess with him, but I don't think he was a ruffian. I wouldn't want to go up against him. He killed 185,000 Assyrians one night after dinner by himself, and he'll wipe up the whole world in Revelation 19. But his manner was not rough and uncouth. I think Esau was. I think it's a genetic thing. So For some reason, Isaac was drawn to that. Rebecca then stepped up. And what a mother does, if you see kids unbalanced, you always want to make that up. You know, you give them more lessons on something or whatever. You know, if you've been a mother or a dad, you know how it is. You want to help that kid. So she probably then stepped up and took Jacob's side because Isaac was probably fending for Esau. Don't know, but that makes sense in a family situation. But I want to tell you that Genesis 25:23 is our kind of our linchpin for this. You know it, but I want to review it. And the Lord said to her, and he's speaking to Rebecca, who found out she was pregnant. Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. See, this is a prophecy. And the older shall serve the younger. They knew that the youngest one, and that would be Jacob, was going to get the blessing. This is not a surprise. We've got four people involved here, and that would be Jacob and Esau, the twins, and the mom and dad, Isaac and Rebecca. And all four would have known this. I am just a believer that it's taught kind of like Rebecca tried to connive this away. Well, read God's word, what he said to her when she was pregnant. Now, these boys are older. She's known this from day one. So has Isaac. Just saying. Just think about it and see what you come up with. I'm going to go ahead to verse 5. Now, Rebecca was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau's son, and Esau went to the field to hunt game and bring it. So Rebecca spoke to Jacob, her son, saying, "Indeed, I heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, saying, 'Bring me game and make savory food for me, that I may eat it and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death.'" I want to say something to that. Sounds to me like Jesus was going to walk into this situation. Maybe he just meant in the presence of prayer before the Lord, but that's not what he said. She heard him say, "In the presence of the Lord, I want this blessing to come." I have a feeling Jesus would have been standing there. That's just me. Maybe not. "Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice according to what I command you. Go now to the flock and bring me from there two choice kids of the goats, and I will make savory food for them for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall take it to your father that he may eat it and that he may bless you before his death." There's been some contention on how could wild game, which I'm guessing it's going to be a deer, antelope, or something like that, taste like goat. I don't know. I don't eat goat. I don't eat much deer and antelope. But I'm guessing with any spices, and it says savory, that means spices. I'm guessing she could spice something up, cook it up till it's really tender. It would probably taste very similar. And those of you that cook wild game know that if you spice things up, I know deer jerky I've had tastes very much undistinguishable from beef jerky because it's all the spices. So I think this savory thing plays into that's how she could do it. And she could get those fast. Nobody had to hunt for those. Those are in the herd.
I think deer tastes kind of like goat.
Does it taste the same?
I had both. I think they kind of taste
alike. Do they? I figured, you know, she would know if he's used to eating her cooking.
Yeah, yeah.
So what, however she usually spices the food, that yeah. would be familiar and likable to his palate.
She knew what he liked.
What he ate. Yeah. Those kind of flavor was.
Well, and I figured good. If it was cooked tender enough with spices, right. it would probably well, taste the same.
Not much, yeah.
Now, I'm and so deer and goat would be.
Yeah, when you shoot deer, all people are like, "What's this?" If you cook it right, it's yeah. good, but a lot of people say it tastes like goat.
But if you had enough the same spices, it probably would. And he's remember, he's older. Now he's 137, so his taster's not as sharp as it used to be either. And they probably made a big deal about it, probably put extra spices. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, because we, crock pot. Yeah. With my deer, I saw the bunch of stuff in there.
And yeah. It was really good. Yeah, that's what she... Yeah. I think that's what
my
she did.
Paul's done that.
Yeah.
So I had someone say at the table we was eating deer, and Kathy, she said, "Oh no, I can't stand deer. I'd never eat it."
And she was eating it.
That's what they did to me with goat hamburger. I baked goat hamburger.
Well, if it was spice.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm the one that mixed it up and didn't know to operate it. Oh
boy. Okay. So see, it would be easy with the spices, I think, to do that. I'm in verse 11. Preparations are made for Jacob's deceptive attempt to steal the blessing. And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Look, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth-skinned man. Perhaps my father will feel me." You know, he'll reach out and grab his hand or something. "And I shall seem to be a deceiver to him." There's that word again. "And I shall bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." But his mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go and get them from me." And he went and got them and brought them to his mother. And his mother made savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the choice clothes of her older son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. So she didn't only put skin, she put his clothes on him. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck where he would reach and feel. Then she gave the savory food and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. Now you will remember when Jacob was born. Remember, Esau was coming out, and Jacob reached out and grabbed his heel, and he was called the heel grabber by the midwives, or trickster, and that also means conniver. Well, he's kind of fitting into that part here. I don't know who's... It's hard to lay blame on this story, because I think there are four people that are all at fault. Isaac didn't follow what he should have. He just should have stood up from the beginning to his older son and said, "I'm sorry, this was God's deal. You will be beneath the... I didn't make the plans. Talk to God." And Rebecca should have followed Isaac's lead then and that and saying, "Boys, you're going to have to get along. God set this up, but there will be plenty for you too." But they didn't do that. They're all of them are underhanded.
They
all of them are...
What society suspected. Yes. For older to be in charge.
Yeah. They couldn't get away from society. Established norms or personal preferences. I mean, it may be that because Esau was gamey and outsidesy and woodsy, that his father really did love him more. But that's not even the issue here. The issue is, what did God say? And I think for us, the lesson in this story is going to be, I hope, when we finish it up, you can't change what God said. You can shift things around. You can tap dance around them. You can throw a bunch of money at them. You can get up on your soapbox and wail and yell. But bottom line is, and just like Travis made the point, God will have his way. And it ain't pretty. If you've tried to go around the backside, this is not a pretty story. This does not make anyone end up looking good. And we're looking directly at the bloodline of Jesus here. And there are some huge flaws. Just pointing them out, and I'm not pointing them out at this expense of saying I'm perfect. I'm not. It gives me hope when I see these stories. So
one thing too, the mom and I talked about.
Yeah.
Is I think this brings out the character of Isaac and Rebecca. I mean, because back when we read in the four, it says spoke to Esau, his son. And then Rebecca said to Jacob, her son. So they're not their son. They're taking ownership of this. Isaac's taking ownership
That's
of Esau.
That's a good point.
She's taking ownership
yeah.
of Jacob. It's not their son. It's my son.
Their
son. This is my son.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're a blended family.
And they're not.
No, but you know what? That's what it's like. That's my son. That's my son.
We saw a little bit of this in the...
Since they were...
I wonder if they immediately did that. You know, you're going to see with Joseph in the Coat of Many Colors, that story is going to have that flavor too.
Yeah.
Because Joseph was so favored over the other sons because he was a son of his favorite wife. Yes. But this, though, is a little surprising because this is the only wife.
Yeah.
But it is. It is what it is. And we're going to go on. I want to read, do you know Charles Spurgeon, the great commentator pastor from 120 years ago? Here's what he says about this. I did copy it because he says it well. All four of them, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau, did not trust each other. Worse yet, they did not trust the Lord. Each one of them schemed and plotted against each other and against God. The whole story reflects no credit upon any of the persons concerned. Isn't that said well? And I believe that's what we're going to find. But yet again, that gives us hope. All right, I'm in verse 18. So he went to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, now this is a direct lie. This is the first lie that we actually see. "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done just as you told me. Please arise, sit, eat of my game, and your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" And he said, "Because," and here is what's really worse of the lie. If you're going to lie, don't lie about the Lord. But so this lying conniver heel grabber says, "Because the Lord your God brought it to me." I have that circle and thought, not good. So not good. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near, then I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son, Esau, or not." Already something is suspicious here, isn't it? Look at this story. I've never one time, if I was sleeping and one of my kids came in, I would come here and feel me so I can see if you're really my kid. Have you ever said anything like that? No. So there's a suspicious nature to this whole saga. Maybe he had an inkling, a discernment that his wife was not on board with this. I don't know. This is just, the words are here. So Jacob went near to Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. Then he said, again, this is going to be another lie. "Are you really my son Esau?" he said. Second lie. And I don't like this because here's what it is. He says, "I am." Now, I don't know if that sends wriggles up and down your spine. You start talking, that's God's name. You know what I'm talking about? I know I'm a nitpicker, but I think every word matters. And when he lies and he says, "I am," I think we have to give a nod to the Holy Father who said Jesus' name is I am. In the burning bush, he says, "I am that I am." And when he stands up in the Gethsemane story right before the cross and the accusers, the 7,000 troops are there, and the high priest says, "Are you Jesus of Nazareth?" And he says, "I am," and they all fall to the ground. This is the word name. This liar says, "Are you my son? Are you really my son? Are you for sure you're my son?" And he says, "I am." I've got a big star on that. Actually, to me, that's like putting a target on your back. Wouldn't want to be him. And he's going to have some recompense for this. We're going to find out there's more that's going to happen to him because of this. He will run and hide, and he will never see his mother again after this. Once he leaves, he never sees her again. There's some payback. God will be not mocked. So he said, "Bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's game, so that my soul may bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate. And he brought him wine, and he drank. And again, I've got that noted. I think wine is very telling here. And I know I'm a teetotaler, so you don't have to listen to me, but it got Noah in a peck of trouble, too. I don't have to review that story to you. It is a mocker, and it is a tool of Satan often I think it's very, very noteworthy that he gave him wine. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing. Oh, I don't know. There's so much in that. I pointed out the words that troubled me. Maybe you saw some other things, but let's go on because the story's not going to get nicer. I'm in verse 27b. "And blessed him and said, 'Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field, which the Lord has blessed. Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven.'" Now this is the blessing. "Of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." And that is a repeat. You should immediately go, heads up, heads up. Let me take you back to Genesis 12:3. This is the everlasting covenant. When God says to Abraham, "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." This is echoing Abraham's blessing from God. This is the eternal covenant. That's why I want to say to people, if you know any verse, if I've taught you anything, you should know Genesis 12:3. That should be a forever in my heart. Do not forget it. Stamp it down. It's really important verse. "I will bless those that bless you." He's talking about the Jews, folks. He's talking about Israel. He's talking about Abraham's kids. Are you listening, Hamas? Are you listening, Hezbollah? You need to understand Genesis 12:3 is a forever covenant. It says everlasting. Last time I checked, there's no end to that.
Are you listening, America?
Yeah, are you listening, Joe Biden? Are you? I mean, I think Jack Hibbs would say that, don't you?
Morning on the radio. I think he's in about, what I tell him, I think what he's talking about now is about 2020. You know, his sermons are,
yeah,
you're never, once in a while he'll give a date.
Yeah. When you don't know quite
when.
But
I think it's at the beginning of some of this, and he's talking about you cannot kick him out of everywhere and expect him to stay. He is gone. And then he was talking about,
yeah,
this, "I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you."
Yeah.
And that, and he said,
it's forever.
Joe, that can't do.
No.
And forget that and then not get anything.
Everlasting.
Yeah.
That's a forever thing. And
yeah,
and for me, if
the
I taught.
Sermon Sunday was, we needed to pray for mercy.
Yeah,
because God has been merciful. But guys, we have to know this. I've had people say to me, "Why is Israel so special? What makes it?" Well, let me tell you about Genesis 12:3. And you guys should have that at the tip of your tongue. Maybe you don't. Maybe you can paraphrase it. You don't have to memorize it exactly. "I will bless those that bless Israel, and I will curse those that curse Israel." I mean, that's really all you need to know. And he means it, guys. So I think here that was important. And also, there's an echo that we're going to find in this 27. That's the echo where it says, "Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." That's exactly saying the same thing. Those two verses are parallels. That's when I remember I always told you, if God says it once, it's huge. If he says it twice, you better write it down. You better underline it. You better star it. You better circle it. Whatever you do to this. But I've got them side by side there for you because those two are God saying it again. By the way, everlasting means never, ever ending. I love this. I just think we, as studiers, know this, and like you said, Jack Hibbs, a lot of people are talking about this. The minute any American president stands up and says they're going to take an inch of soil away from Israel, I want to fall on my face and say, "God, forgive us. We didn't do this. Somebody ahead of us, we don't believe that way." And you need to go before God and beg forgiveness. Like you said, ask for mercy. We need to beg God to forgive America. It may be too late. But he'll forgive us. I mean, individuals, it's never too late. He'll always show you mercy because of the cross. I'm in verse 30. "Now it happened, as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from his hunting. He also had made savory food and brought it to his father and said to his father, Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that your soul may bless me. And his father Isaac said to him, who are you? Now it starts to twist. So he said, I'm your son, your firstborn Esau. Esau says an interesting thing when he says that your soul may bless me. We do not understand the Hebrew of this. It was not just a flippant thing to say the older son got more and blah, 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 and they got the blessing. They really did. They got twice the property, whether it's the property they're interested in. But what actually Isaac is imparting here is he is setting the bloodline of Jesus. That's what this means. Never discount what this is about. Whether Esau implies that or whether Jacob implies that, Isaac and Rebekah know it. They've been told from day one from Abraham, they've been told, you must be pure. We're going to carry the Messiah. It's an everlasting covenant. This covenant is a big deal. And what this old father, this 137-year-old man, is it going to impart to one of his twins? He's chosen Esau, disregarding what God told Rebekah and him. And he, by golly, is going to impart that on Esau so that the bloodline of the Messiah will part down through Esau. We're going to see why that God never intended that to be, because we're going to see who Esau marries. God knew ahead of time. And that's why this is that way. Again, we say four people are wrong in getting the right thing done. The right thing is for the bloodline to come down through Jacob. It has to, because you're going to see who Esau marries. But they did it in a usurping way to what God had already said about. God didn't need their help. Had they just obeyed and been honest with those boys. And that doesn't mean that Jacob had to be mean about it. It doesn't mean that Isaac and Rebekah had to be mean about it. They could have all said, hey, Jacob could have said, Dad's got plenty of stuff. I'm going to give you lots of these herds and lots of these sheep and lots of this cattle. And they're going to be plenty. I'm going to make sure you're rich. You don't need to worry about that. And Rebekah and Isaac could have overseen that. The boys could have both been set up with wealth. But they didn't any of them do it right. They didn't any of them do it right. And God had to step in and do what he does, which he always does for me too. I'm in 33. Then Isaac trembled exceedingly. Have you ever heard of shaking in your boots? I'm thinking he's going, oh no. And in his mind, he must be. I can't prove this. But he must be going back and saying, oh no, God stepped in and did what he was supposed to, that I tried to connive and twist. I think Isaac is feeling some guilt here. I think the trembling's not fear, unless it's fear of God. I think it's more of a sadness and a realization that he really messed up. God caught him and said, who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I have blessed him. And double whammy, repeat two things. And indeed, he shall be blessed. I have blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed. In other words, done deal. Stamp it done two times really seals the deal here. The fact that he says it twice is huge. Huge. That's how Hebrew is. This Hebrew Jewish Bible, if a scribe or a rabbi would stand up and repeat something twice, the whole congregation would go, that's just their culture. That's part of this Bible you have to understand. The repeating of two things is like, wow, we better know this. So the fact this old man who had messed up royally and got chastised by God immediately knew what he had done, he repeats it twice to show everyone in the family that this younger one is the blessed one. He now has turned. He has realize he's messed up. He's sorry for his older son, but he says it once, and then he whammies it home by saying, yes, he is blessed indeed. That's huge in the Jewish culture. So we have to understand a couple of things here, too. I want to read something. The Apostle Paul. I love that if I don't get it in the Old Testament, sometimes the New Testament will define it. I'm in Hebrews 11:12. This is the Apostle Paul writing. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And that is a showing, a point back to this when he messes up so bad and he realizes what he's done. He says it twice. Apostle Paul is telling us that was faith. That even in the midst of a major, major catastrophe, this could have been a major catastrophe, that what did Jacob do? He got his act together pretty fast. Evidently went back to God in prayer in his mind and said, yes, I blessed him, and he will be blessed indeed. So that's Paul saying that double emphasis at the end is a big deal. We wouldn't pick that up so much in English writing, but in Jewish, it's a red letter, stamp it done, open your eyes and read that again. I'm in verse 34. When Esau heard the words of his father, those last two phrases I just said, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me also, O my father. But he said, your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing. And that's kind of a lie. That's kind of a lie. Isaac's kind of lying there. Jacob did come with deceit, but he didn't take away Esau's blessing. Esau was not to be the bearer of the firstborn. God had already told them. So he had deceived his dad into getting what was rightfully his, is what really happened. So that's kind of a double intento there where I think, yeah, it's just kind of a little lie. Verse 36, and Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. Now that's the heel catcher story. Is he not named Jacob? He took my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing. Do you remember this first time he did this? He really didn't trick his brother. His brother came in, I'm so hungry. I've been hunting all day. Give me some of your lentil stew. And his brother goes, yeah, sell your birthright. Well, sure, I hate my birthright anyway. Yeah, yada, 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 give me that red stew. And he ate it. So he's telling his dad, he's tricked me twice now. Who's tricked him? His self has tricked his self is what's happened. He has fallen victim to his own self's sins. One, not really valuing his birthright and throwing it away for a bowl of stew. This time, going ahead and going hunting and fixing a savory pot and all that, knowing he did not deserve the blessing. Don't kid yourself. He knew this was supposed to be his brother's. I'm trying to make the point. We've missed the point of this story. They all four are at fault here. All four of them. Have you not reserved a blessing for me? Then Isaac answered and said to Esau, indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren I have given to him as servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I do now for you, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you only one blessing, my father? Bless me. Me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. In the Jewish culture, there is one first son blessing. There's not two to give. So in one way, it's true. He got the bloodline blessing. Esau's not going to be the carrier of the Messiah gene. He's just not. He's messed up. He's not. It is going to come from his brother. And it's more than that. He's going to have the prestige of the firstborn. He's carrying the name of his father. He just is. And Esau knows that, and that's not retrievable. That can't be gotten back. I suspect, and this is another Linda-ism, so please disbelieve this if you choose. I really think with Esau's heart, and we're going to see it later, he's more materialistic than he's giving on here. I think he's really lamenting that he's not going to get as much earthly goods. I think it's really more about the money to him. I think it always has been. I think when he so flippantly gave his birthright away for a bowl of soup, he obviously didn't care about that. I guess it's a little bit like here. And the closest I was trying to analyze how this would be. So I inherited some land from my parents. And let's say I went to my sister's house and she was making a big pot of chili and I was really hungry and I didn't want to cook. And I said, I want a bowl of your chili. And she goes, yeah, give me Dad's land. Well, sure, I don't want it anyway. And I just whipped it out and gave it over to her. That's kind of what happened with the birthright. That he was so flippant about his inheritance, Esau I'm talking about, was so flippant. Oh, sure, I don't care anything about it anyway. And the birthright would entail being the head son, having the bloodline, taking care of Dad's business, getting the lion's share of the property and all that. And he goes, yeah, sure, hand it on over. I need some soup. Now, this is how selfish, self-centered, and short-sighted he was. He couldn't look past his growling stomach to the future. So you don't value something very much if that's... And that was my point. I think we see a character flaw in Esau that God saw in the womb. God saw that. He saw that character flaw. He cared more about his momentary pleasure, the satisfaction of his innate needs at that moment, more than the future. So what if he'd have missed lunch? Would you give up your inheritance? But that's if you're real self-centered and you're more concerned about your earthly needs at that point. I'm just saying. I think you need to look at these because it tells a part of a person's innards. I want to review that story too. And it again is from Genesis 25. I'm reading verse 29. Now Jacob cooked a stew and Esau came in from the field and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. See how exaggerating he is about being hungry? I'm about to die. So what is this birthright to me? Then Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose, and went his way. Now, thus Esau despised his birthright. I think we're getting more to the heart of the story. Esau was so flippant about this birthright that he put his earthly needs for lunch above his inheritance and his responsibilities. Because when you get the birthright, you're also responsible to take care of your parents. You're supposed to, you know, be the head of the family. There's some responsibility. And he goes, yeah, no, I'm hungry. I don't give a rip about that other stuff. So that's already a character flaw we see. And he complains to his dad and goes, well, this is twice now he's tricked me. I don't see any trick with this. I mean, Jacob was minding his own business cooking. And, yeah, he came in and he wanted this. He said, I wonder if he just threw it out saying, oh, you're so hungry, why don't you just sign over your birthright? Thinking his brother might say, yeah, right, no. But he jumped on it, said, sure, it doesn't mean anything to me because it says he despised his birthright. That's not my words. That's what the Bible says. Let's look at Esau and realize why God did not pick him. Again, I want to take a key verse here. We just read it, but it bears repeating. Genesis 25, 22. And the Lord said to her, this is Rebekah, two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. Big ta-da here. And the older shall serve the younger. You should know that you know that you know that, because this is the heart of the story. This is years before. She's pregnant with these babies. They're now grown men. It's decades before. And they all knew the story. They all knew the promise. If you know anything about God, He's not a God of mysteries. He makes His word clear and loud and obvious. And if you choose not to hear it and throw your birthright away for a bowl of lentil soup, sad for you. Sad, sad, sad for you. Not God's fault. And it's not Rebecca's fault, and it's not Isaac's fault, and it's not Jacob's fault. And it's really not Esau's fault. God set the stage. He sets the parameters that we're to live at. And this, he's going to look at this bloodline. This is going to be his son's bloodline. And you start seeing the character flaws coming out in Esau. He doesn't want that bloodline for his son. He doesn't want someone who despises his birthright. He doesn't want someone who throws away all he knows for a bowl of soup. The flippancy of that just boggles me. Then I want to read something else that Hebrews 12 said that I think you're going to find interesting. Looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Now this is Paul talking. Lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble. Of course, you know Esau's going to be bitter. And by this many become defiled, lest there be, now I underline these, any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. Paul explains his story. There's two flaws in Esau that you may not have seen in the Genesis rendition, but Paul points him out. He calls him a profane person. Of course, I had to look that up. Anything that has no link to God, vulgar, obscene, and irreverent. This reminds me of the Cain story a little bit. Remember when the two boys were bringing sacrifices, Cain and Abel? And God had set down a set of rules of what you bring. And Cain goes, no, I'm bringing fruits from my garden and vegetables and wheat and stuff. I'm not bringing that meat stuff. And God didn't accept it. He was irreverent to the rules set down by God. And that's what Esau is profane. Paul says he's profane. That means he has no link to God. That's what that word. And he also called him, what's the other word?
Fornicator.
Well, I don't think I need to explain that to you. You know what that means. And we're going to see how that's true by who he chooses to marry. So when I keep going back to when these baby boys are in her tummy, well, we know the psalmist tells us that he knew you were knit in your mother's womb. He knew you from that point. He knew the two different lineages that were going to come from this. And he could not choose Esau to be the bloodline of his son. It goes back to that seed war again.
Similar to Esau, if he was a big burly guy and a hunter and everything, yeah, you know, there was an assumption in his mind, look, I'm the oldest brother. I'm a lot better than the little one. I can do all this and this. I'm going to get it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I
don't care.
I'm entitled to it.
Yeah.
It's mine. What's the
back off?
You know, kids, shut up.
Yeah.
You know,
go away.
I'm going to get it anyway. You know, arrogance, kind of.
It is. It's in that vulgarity, that arrogance, that profaneness, and that's no link to God. When you say, I don't care what you said, I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
That's what Paul tells us. And the promiscuous thing is going to be funny because we're going to see how that plays out. And I keep hinting at that, but we will do that. But in verse 39, we go on. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and the dew of the heaven from above. By your sword you shall live. How many thinks this is a really good indication of the Arab nations today? I start listening to some of this. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. This is three times now Isaac has repeated this. Remember the rules in the Bible. One's big, two's aha, three is like, oh, wow. Three times he said to this boy, sorry, you will serve your brother. And it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. Now, that means he's going to part away from his brother. He's actually going to, they're going to get separated, and they're not going to see each other for years. When Jacob flees to Laban's because of fear that his brother's going to kill him, his brother probably would have killed him. So they break the yoke from it, because twins are yoked. If you think about when they're born, I know back then they didn't realize they would have been in separate sacks. Or if they're identical, they're not identical because they don't look alike. So they had separate sacks. But they always thought the twins were yoked. And this is when they said, God, or the prophecy is they will be separated. And they are. They're separated forever. Verse 41. So Esau hated Jacob. Now, I think hate is a strong word, but that's exactly what the original language said, hated Jacob because of the blessing which his father blessed him, and Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, which that's really not true. He didn't die for 43 more years, but they thought he was dying. And I will kill my brother Jacob. And the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning you by intending to kill you. In other words, he's comforting himself. He's not going to do it now because he knows he's going to. That's a strange way of comforting yourself. Are you starting to get a picture of Esau's heart? Would you comfort yourself by knowing you're going to kill your brother? I mean, that's bizarre, isn't it? But that's what the words are. Yet, we know this, and it's going to be 43 more years before the death of this father, and Jacob's going to flee. So there are some real high prices paid for all this intrigue. I'm in verse 43. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice, arise. Flee to my, this is Rebekah speaking. Flee to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him a few days. We're going to see that turns into years. I think that's a satire. Until your brother's fury turns away. Until your brother's anger turns away from you and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you from there. She never sees him again. She gets punished too. She dies before he ever comes back. Why should I be bereaved also of both in one day? She's saying if your brother kills you, the price that he will pay is someone will kill him, because that's how the Jewish law is. You kill someone, then you're killed. So she said, if I let that happen, I'm going to lose you both in one day. And Rebekah said to Isaac, I'm weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, like those who are the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? So Esau takes brides from the daughters of Heth. Let me tell you who Heth is. Heth is a Hittite. If you will remember, when Abraham went to buy a field, which had a cave in it, for his wife Sarah's burial, which later everybody gets buried in. It becomes the patriarch's burial place. I tried to point out to you then that the Hittites are Nephilim. And ancient texts, not Bible, books like Josephus, books like Herodotus wrote, books like ancient historians wrote that the sons of Heth were satyrs, which means half goat, half man. They're Nephilim. Could that be? Sure. Is that as far out as you think? Probably not. Because we realized Abraham lived among Nephilim. He was fighting giant wars all around him. So why couldn't that be? But these are the daughters, this is the lineage, that Esau's chosen to bring two wives into this bloodline of Jesus family. Get the picture now? Why God can't let Esau be the son of promise, be the son of blessing, be the bloodline, because he's introduced Nephilim blood. Did you have something to say? Oh, so that's who the sons of Heth are. So she's already, and Rebekah knows this, she's lamenting, and she said, I've got to get Jacob out of here. Not only is his brother going to kill him, because he's so angry, but there's women all around that he cannot marry these. We've got to send him back to my people. Now, her brother's going to be a piece of work, but he is human. So she said, we got to send him back, basically saying to protect this seed war, this bloodline, because he's chosen now. Jacob has been chosen. Isaac gave him the blessing. He is the bloodline. So now Rebekah, in her smartness, and you can say all she wants to, whether about being conniving or what, she gets this about the bloodline. She says to Isaac, we have to send him away from here. We've got to get him back to Haran, H-A-R-A-N, the town or the area, to Laban and get a wife for him back there, because he can't marry these daughters of Heth, these Hittites that are around us. He cannot. Esau's already done it. He's already corrupted this part of the bloodline. See, if you understand the seed war, some of more of this conversation makes more sense. So she's punished in one way for her deceit. She never, when she sends Jacob away, she will never see him again. Well, she does now in heaven. Yeah, but I meant on this side of the earth. And to be around a son, her Esau son, that is marrying Hittite women and probably having Nephilim children, I can't imagine the heartbreak of that. Parents today that have children that go astray and they marry like druggies or, you know, drug dealers or criminals, and they see their children being raised like that, that's kind of the heartbreak. But this is worse because this is a genetic thing we're talking about. I want to read, I'm going to close this whole story, and it's a kind of a sordid story because I told you earlier, and I agree with Spurgeon, that all four were at fault. The only light at the end of this tunnel is that we do see the bloodline is protected. The path for Jesus is still going to be, and that's the Jesus part of this story. Does God redeem Esau or Edom at the end? And I want to end always on a positive note. And let me tell you this. As bad as Esau was, as awful as his Hittite wives were, as corrupted as that bloodline was, Jacob told Esau that you still will be blessed. Here's how God keeps his promise. It is clear in the Jewish remnant that they will be fleeing to the Judean wilderness where Old Testament passages teach, and this is also like in Revelation 12, that Israel will be miraculously protected for the latter half of the tribulation. The place of her protection is said in the Old Testament to be Bozrah, and I'm going to quote to you from the famous Jeremiah 49. We'll study that later, and it's really, really good. For I have sworn by myself, declares the Lord, that Bozrah will become an object of horror, a reproach, a ruin, and a curse, and all its cities will become perpetual ruins. That, by the way, is Petra today, the city in ruins. I have heard a message from the Lord, and an envoy is sent among the nations, saying, gather yourselves together and come against her and rise up for battle. Bozrah is the region in the southwest of Jordan where the ancient fortress city of Petra is located. And Isaiah puts the cap on this stone. And in verse 1, Isaiah said, who is this comes from Eden? Now remember, Eden is Esau. Who is this who comes from Eden with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. Of course, this is Jesus he's pointing to. It is I who speak, now this person tells you, it is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red, your garments like the one who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. What Jesus is saying, and Isaiah sees him. He sees, who is this king-like person I see leaving Bozrah, like dressed like a king in regal robes, but he's all bloodstained. And if you know the tribulation story, at the midway point, when the Antichrist stands up in the center of the temple and declares himself God, and commits the abomination of desolation, God tells the Israelites, and a third of them remember, you run. You drop what you're doing. You don't go get a coat. You don't go up on your house and get a blanket. You don't get anything. You grab your baby. Let's hope you're not pregnant or nursing, because you're going to have to run across east, across that desert, and you're going to have to run into the mountains of Bozrah, Edom, Esau. This is Esau's country. And you're going to go into the ancient ruined city of Petra, a third of the remnant, and you're going to hide there. And Edom and Esau are going to take care of you against the Antichrist. So when Jesus steps off that big white war horse in Revelation 19, Isaiah 63 says he steps right over into Bozrah and he kills everything in his way and his robes get stained blood and he saves his remnant because Edom, Esau, has protected the promised ones. God gives Edom, Esau a chance in the end to redeem. This is the God we serve. Bozrah or Petra is a place where up to a couple million Jews have been hidden away since the middle of the tribulation when they fled from Judea. The Lord has nourished them there for those 3.5 years, and now he defends this Jewish remnant that by the time of the second coming has converted en masse to Jesus as their Messiah. Christ has blood on his garments for defending the Jews against the army of the Antichrist, who have gathered themselves to attack the Jews at Armageddon. Such a force arrayed against the Lord's people requires his personal intervention. This he does first at Petra, Bozrah, Edom, Esau. Esau steps up in the end, and God gives him a chance to be redeemed to save his own. I want to say, yes! Yay! This is the spin on this story. And the final thing I want to end with is God's plan is perfect. And we do not need to help him accomplish it. And that's a thumb pointing back at myself. So, Father, I thank you for this lesson. I thank you that in the simplicity of four people messing up, we see the Redeemer. We see you even in the very end of times redeeming Esau to become once again united with his brother. And we love that. I love that every story, every tale, every sentence, every word is all about you. And Lord, just help us be learning from this, that we would be better, that would be sharper against the wiles of the devil, and that we would be more focused on the gospel, sharing it for those until you come. And so, Father, I ask in Jesus' name now, if anyone's listening that they don't know you, they would fall to their face and ask your Son, Jesus Christ, to come into their hearts, forgive their sins, and make them a new person. We love you and we worship you and we give you all the glory. In Jesus' name, amen.